Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for February 16th, 2017, the Freaks and Leaks edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm here in Slate's D.C. studio with John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation. Hello.
Merry day.
John.
Merry day and be of good cheer.
Thank you. You too. Right back at you. And from New Haven is, of course, Emily Bazelon, host of the Slate Political Gabfest. No, of the New York Times Magazine.
I'm not the host of the New York Times Magazine, although I sort of like that idea. I could just like stand there with a glass of wine instead of actually working.
On this week's Gabfest, holy moly, it's ridiculous. An assassin wearing an LOL t-shirt poisons North Korea's heir apparent in broad daylight in an airport. The Labor Secretary nominee withdraws amid allegations of spousal abuse and other things. Trump gets a shady trademark. Trump spreads dangerous lies about autism. ICE starts deportation proceedings against a woman who is turned in by her abusive boyfriend after she sought a protective order against him. A California dam is terrifyingly unstable. North Korea tested a new missile. Yet none of these stories will even rate a mention on the show that we are about to do.
And yet you just mentioned them.
Well, yes, it is a cycle. It is eating its own tail.
I thought that trademark was actually awarded a year ago and just went into effect this week.
Maybe so. Record. We're not talking about it. That's because the four-week-old Trump presidency is so chaotic, dangerous, and incompetent that we need to talk about the major ways it's chaotic, dangerous, and incompetent. First, the Russia scandal, the ouster of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and reports that Trump campaign officials were in frequent contact with Russian intelligence officials throughout the campaign. Then the populist revolt to save Obamacare and the Republican paralysis about how, whether to repeal it, or is it paralysis? Maybe it's not paralysis. And then Trump abandons the two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians. What does that mean? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter and for Slate Plus, a new take on the emoluments clause from Emily Bazelon. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. Reminder, we have two live shows coming up, dear listeners. If you are in California, March 1st, just 2 weeks away, we're going to do a show at the theater at the Ace Hotel. You can get tickets at slate.com/live. It's going to be a great show. Oh, which reminds me, we have to scheme about that, guys. We got to scheme about that. And that's
our
first.
It's going to be a great show for which we will soon make plans
It's going to be a great show. How could it not be a great show given this moment in history? It is our first live show in Los Angeles, so please come at the Ace Hotel on Wednesday, March 1st. And also, on Wednesday, May 10th, we're going to do a show in D.C. for the 100 days of the Trump presidency, if we make it to that, at the Warner Theater. Go to slate.com/live for more information about that. Wednesday, May 10th in D.C., Wednesday, March 1st in Los Angeles. See you there. I personally look forward to a day when I cannot remember who Michael Flynn is. That's a day in our future. I didn't know who he was 6 months ago, and I hope not to know who he is in about a year from now. The three-star general was ousted this week as National Security Advisor following revelations that he secretly contacted the Russian ambassador before the inauguration, denied it, perhaps had the vice president lie about it on national television, kept lying and lying about it himself, only to have it leaked to the Washington Post that he had been lying about it.
Alternative facts, though.
Yes. Yeah. That's an alternative voice. You'll hear from that alternative voice in 1 second. Flynn seems to have possibly indicated in the conversations with the Russian ambassador that the Trump administration would ease up on Russia and ease up on some sanctions. This Flynn story has been coupled with a second, basically separate story that several Trump campaign officials, and Paul Manafort is the only one kind of definitively named, had frequent contact with Russian intelligence officials during the campaign, a campaign you will remember that was dominated by Russian hacking of Democrats, the release of information of Russian hacks of Democrats, and general Russian malevolent interference to disrupt the election and help Donald Trump get elected, facts which have been denied vehemently by Trump himself. We are joined for this segment by Julia Yaffe, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Julia.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Do you want to just, Julia, just start us off with a what the hell? Are these two stories one story or two stories?
They're one and a half stories. The thing I have to say about, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but in defense of Flynn and Manafort, Flynn, first of all, and I've heard this from a number of senior State Department people who really, really don't like the current president, including Michael McFaul, who was Obama's ambassador to Moscow, who has said this publicly. Being in contact with the Russian ambassador during the transition is not a big deal. Everybody does it. You'd be stupid not to do it. The thing where he crossed the line was lying, you know, lying to the boss, lying to Vice President Mike Pence.
So when the writing's on the wall in this way, in this like interregnum time, that's just not really like something.
Well, also, yeah, and just and being in touch with foreign diplomats is not apparently, or so people in the State Department tell me, is not a problem. You're supposed to be doing that. The problem is that he lied to the vice president and potentially to the FBI, which is, as I understand, a felony. As for Manafort and the Russians and the Trump campaign being in touch all the time, you'll remember in the New York Times article that came out this week, Paul Manafort is quoted saying, it's not like these guys wear name tags that say, hey, I'm Russian intelligence. You don't know. We actually have a great Q&A up on the Atlantic website with Andrei Soldatov, who was a Russian journalist and scholar of the Russian security and intelligence services. And he's like, he's right, that under Putin, the line between civilians and security service officers has really been blurred. And in your day-to-day life in Russia, you don't know who is and who is not an agent of the secret services. You don't know who to trust. But there is, like, they could have just been in touch with Russian businessmen.
But so this is not the answer I expect. So basically you're saying there's no scandal for Flynn because he was saying things.
No, that's not what I said. That's not what I said.
And that there's no scandal for Manafort because he's talking, you know, he's just talking
about it. There's a scandal.
Okay,
What's the scandal? I told you he lied to the vice president and potentially the FBI.
Let me take you out of the hot seat, Julia. So the lying to the vice president is a problem, although the question still very much at play is whether it was in fact lying to the vice president that was wrong or getting caught lying to the vice president that was wrong. Because when the president came out in his press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu and was asked about Flynn, he said it was terrible how he was mistreated by the press. The day before, his press secretary had said the reason he fired Flynn or asked for his resignation, I should say, is that the president had lost trust in him. So which is it? Is it he'd lost trust? Or is it that the press railroaded him? And the press's railroad, to the extent, and that's my word, not his, was simply printing the fact that Flynn had lied to the vice president. And now there's a report on Thursday about the fact that that Flynn not only talked about sanctions with the Russian ambassador, but it was the central subject of one of the phone calls. And so it's the kind of thing that you can't sort of forget. It appears that Flynn was in contact with the Russians or the Russian ambassador throughout the campaign, which means there was a period where it was concurrent, where he was learning as a member of the Trump national security team from intelligence briefings during the campaign that the Russians were engaged in an active effort to undermine the American election. So he had that information in one half of his brain, and the other half of his brain, he was having a conversation with the Russian ambassador. And so in that case, as even the most benign conversations, and these are conversations that took place before the election took place. So that's different apart from the totally natural conversations you would expect him to have with the Russians after Trump was elected. But there was a period where he was having conversations with the Russians when he knew in his head that the Russians were trying to undermine the election. So what were those conversations about? Who was directing him to have those conversations? And what was the point of those conversations? That is a part of the other story, which is the Russian conversations held by people in the Trump campaign. What was the purpose of those? Were they just coincidental? Were they ones where they didn't know who they were talking to? The thing that bumps up against is that twice, well, multiple times, but at least twice in interviews I did, Kellyanne Conway and Mike Pence, who was then just Governor Mike Pence, not Vice President Mike Pence, categorically denied that anybody in the campaign had had any conversation with the Russians. So they are on the record saying none of this happened. Now, that could be just a misunderstanding. Manafort and the rest of them didn't know they were talking to intelligence people, or it could be a denial of the kind that we saw Mike Pence give about Flynn's conversation on sanctions, which turned out to be inoperative because he had been lied to by Flynn. So those are all also at play here as a part of this.
To add one more thing, and you alluded to this, John, this question of who directed Flynn to have these conversations raises the question of whether he was really doing this on his own or whether Trump knew about these conversations, was, in fact, asking him to have them. And that's, I don't think we have any sense of what the answer is. And so then one is left with this kind of questions of plausibility. Would an advisor in the kind of capacity Flynn was serving in have been freestyling, or would he have been talking to his principal? And that also goes for this other set of conversations that, you know, Manafort, plus there are several other people, other campaign aides who were involved in those. We don't really know who was directing those. And then I guess the last thing, John, is there's a third possibility about those denials in the interviews with you, which is that they weren't inadvertent the way I think we are crediting Pence's denials, but that they were deliberate obfuscations, lies, in other words. Mm-hmm. That's possible.
And then there's the added political element of Mike Flynn on the stage at the Republican National Convention, joining the crowd, chanting, lock her up, and saying, if I had done a tenth of what she did, I would be in jail. You know, there's the problem of optics. I'm not saying there's no scandal. I think there's just, we have a lot of questions. And I disagree with Representative Jason Chaffetz that the matter has resolved itself essentially with Mike Flynn's resignation. If anything, it's, you know, we have the first thread that might pull apart the sweater.
Why is it, John, that the Republicans are acting so lugubriously?
That's not the right word.
Lugubriously.
That means sad, doesn't it? Slow. No, it means slow.
Slow.
Well, don't you mean laboriously?
Yeah. Isn't lugubrious like melancholy?
Interesting. Seriously? Maybe I may be wrong.
John's looking it up.
Lugubrious. A small door used to enter. No, sorry. Looking or. Sorry. We went down to Target and got us four lugubrious.
Lugubri.
Yes, we got Lugubri, which is also a lovely place just outside of Tuscany. looking or sounding sad and dismal.
You're right. Wow. They're not acting lugubriously at all.
No.
They're just acting.
Sorry,
they're just dragging their nice correction there.
Came in with the fact
studying
check.
Studying for the SAT over here.
Why are the Republicans...
Laboriously.
It's not even laboriously, because laboriously isn't laboriously... not to have another...
That they're laboring.
We are now really laboring.
Dilatory?
Yes. Why are they so fucking slow? Fucking slow. Acting on evidence that our traditional enemy was acting to disrupt fundamental institution of the United States, our election, and that the president colluded with them. Why?
Right.
At what point do Republicans feel willing to speak up and honestly investigate this? This is a shocking...
Here's why I think there's a... So the one thing is they don't want to look like they're in the pylon. There is a pylon for good reason. This is not like he lied about his, you know, whether he paid an undocumented worker.
That's the other nominee.
I know. That's another nominee. But I guess my point is, this is not small beer. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. And there are the analogy only goes so far. But, you know, one of the central questions at the heart of the Benghazi investigation and disappointment and anger, the differences are different. Benghazi people died. An American ambassador died. Of course, the differences are different. But central to it was whether lies were said out loud, actually, on Face the Nation, because the administration told Susan Rice, then the UN ambassador, to lie. And why did they tell her to lie? And were there lies as a part of the system? And there was an active investigation to go throughout the entire Obama administration to figure out where the lies came from and what the initiating act of the lie was, and did the president know, and what role did the CIA have, and where was Hillary Clinton, and on and on and on. There was a huge channel of that investigation that was about lying. So this is not a small deal. So I guess my point is it's well worth covering. But for Republicans right now, they feel like the press is the opposition at war with the administration, and they don't want to be part of the pylon. And also, I think secondarily, or maybe primarily, Donald Trump is the conveyance vehicle towards getting past a whole bunch of things that Republicans have long wanted, that they believe in, and that they think will make America better. And the transaction at the heart of the relationship between Congress and the president is we will go along with things that we might otherwise have criticized because we see a huge upside from your administration. And I would just say a couple of things. I mean, the upside is the Neil Gorsuch nomination. The upside is Betsy DeVos. As much as liberals didn't like her, she is an advocate for school choice, which Republicans like, and on down the line. So there are a lot of things that Donald Trump did. Look at his press conference with Bibi Netanyahu, basically showing a greater friend of Israel for Republicans of a kind than we've had in the presidency. And so there are a lot of big reasons to stick with him. So why join?
Just for the record.
You disagree what? That about Israel?
That he's really being a greater friend of Israel.
But I'm saying this is from the Republican
perspective.
Well, this is also from the Republican perspective. They think he's a stronger friend of Israel.
He's also very popular with the base, right?
Well, that's right.
And, you know, you don't want to, a month after he's become president, a few months after he's become elected in this upset, to go against your voters who voted against the establishment, against the political establishment.
Sure, absolutely.
And so you have Republicans doing these unbelievable gymnastics. Like Chuck Grassley yesterday said, you know, well, the U.S., remember, they interfered in this election in 1954, and citing instances when the U.S. interfered in foreign elections, which is something you would normally expect coming out of Moscow, this tactic called whataboutism, now being used by conservative Republican. Yeah, it makes my brain explode.
Right. But I mean, John, you're absolutely right. And
so is Julia.
And yet we all know that if this scandal were flipped, we all know that the Republican behavior would be totally different. Mm-hmm. We all know that. And I actually suspect the Democrats' behavior would be totally different. I think there's a kind of complicitousness and a willingness to throw away core aspects of American institutional democracy in the Republican Party right now that is absolutely terrifying.
Can I reframe that for a second?
Yes, reframe it. Go stand and defend.
No. I think the definition to get clear in the way we talk about this is, of course there are instances in which the party in power suddenly becomes situationally transactional about the things they believe when they're in power. We see that all the time. And so that is just sort of what we could call garden variety hypocrisy. What's happening here, the ball to keep the eye on, is what level here is beyond that. And that's why you see some Republicans not going down. I mean, you see John McCain and Lindsey Graham.
The only two anyone can ever cite.
Well, no. I think that you saw this week one definite break. And again, it's right along this line I'm trying to define. You had Roy Blunt from Missouri, just reelected senator, saying there should absolutely be an independent investigation into Flynn. You saw Bob Corker saying Flynn should be questioned. You've seen other Republican senators say that inquiry is necessary here. So I think I'm just trying to keep the eye on that.
Also, the investigation into Flynn is not at all the investigation which we need. The investigation of Flynn is fine. The investigation we need is what was happening in the campaign with all of these other people.
Yeah. Well, that's ongoing.
Well, and that brings us to the intelligence community and the Justice Department.
But that
intelligence community busy. Sorry, John.
No.
Busy behaving in deplorable ways and sabotaging the nation. Yes, go ahead.
Is that really what you think? Your view of these leaks? That they're sabotaging the
nation? I don't know. It's troubling all the time. No, I think probably it's okay.
This is them responding. I mean, he essentially declared war on the intelligence community when he accused them of making stuff up and lying and being out to get him. And from what I hear, they're freaking out internally and about, you know, the security of the country. And they're fighting back. This is what it looks like. But they fight back anonymously.
Right. But then we have no idea whether what they're saying is true or not, right? It's very, very hard to judge because it's all coming out in these forms of leaks. We don't have documents.
Well, it was true with Flynn, right? I mean, he admitted
100%.
It was true, right?
Yes. Well, right, that part. But I feel very uncertain about what to trust out of these leaks because of the way they're coming about, and the incentives could be exactly what you said. They're protecting the country, and amen to them. Or they could be revenge against a president they see as an aggressor who's about to appoint essentially a crony of his to come and do some sweeping review of their work, which in fact sounds like maybe the DNI is overstaffed and it's not a crazy idea to take a look. But again, the sort of presentation of this is is very threatening to the intelligence community. And then I also want to note that the Justice Department, which obviously oversees the FBI, is run by a close ally of Trump's, Jeff Sessions, who has said he is not going to distance himself from any of these investigations. And we don't know what effect that is going to have either on any potential investigation or probe or prosecution. I mean, like you said, Julia, if Flynn really did lie to the FBI, that's a felony. The Justice Department doesn't seem interested in pursuing that. Maybe that's okay. They don't pursue every crime, but like, why not? And what are we to make of the fact that right now we don't have an independent prosecutor or any kind of independent commission doing this review? And that is... that is just like kind of, it's just an uncomfortable reality of the way our system's working right now.
And you have, and remember Comey, you know, Comey yes. has in some ways painted himself into a corner with the weird precedents he had invented and set for himself during the campaign. Like,
weird
why is
bad.
It, right? Like, where is the presser on Flynn lying or not lying to the FBI? Why isn't he sending a letter to Jason Chaffetz saying, we're looking into it and we're going to let you know? So now his silence is deafening, right? Because now the FBI is in the mix and he's not saying anything.
Skepticism about all of these leaks is hugely warranted. That's an important message for all the people, consumers of news, but it's a huge and important message for the way we do our work. And so I just want to like reiterate what Emily was saying.
Although, yeah, it feels really important not to get ahead of the facts right now.
Well, what's been so good about the reporting from the Post and the Times in particular and CNN, that these are deeply sourced stories and a lot of anonymous sourcing, but that they're not single source. It's nine people on the Flynn, four people on the Times story about Russia contacts. John, one reason why I think Republicans may want to reconsider their all-in support or refusal to separate themselves from Trump is that one of the problems that clearly is coming up in the Trump administration, which we haven't seen in that I can remember, is that he has staffed his administration with people who are really not apparently not very good at their job, and he can't get better people in. It's like a toxic hellscape in there, and so you can only get the incompetents and zealots, and thus, I mean, I'm sure Republicans are enthusiastic to get all this stuff done, but that you can't get it done if you can't get people hired, or B, the people you do get hired are consistently lying, embarrassing you. Like, is there anything the Republicans can do to redress that part of it?
Well, we'll talk about this when we talk about the Affordable Care Act and repealing, replacing, repairing, or retrofitting it, because Obamacare, tax reform, unwinding Dodd-Frank, three big things that the Republicans want to do. Two of those are going to require patient, strategic, committed, focused effort on the part of the White House and Congress in tandem to do those things. That's super hard, even with the best politicians in the world on both sides. I'm not quite getting to your point yet, but one of the reasons it's tough to have a White House and the Republicans in Congress in sync is that Donald Trump is not a traditional Republican. That's not about his behavior. It's about his ideology. He is malleable, transactional, and pragmatic. And so usually what happens in these deals is everybody knows most of the dance steps. And so if there's not conversation between the White House and Congress, they can do the dance until they have their conversation, but they're pretty much sure that they're not going to put a foot wrong. But when the president has all kinds of other ideas and is willing to change those ideas or float those ideas, they don't know where to put the feet. And so we saw one small example of this when Mike Flynn resigned. Paul Ryan said, you know, it was great that the White House asked him to resign the minute they heard that he hadn't told the truth. Well, news report next minute came out. Turns out they'd known for more than 2 weeks. Now multiply that by a billion, because all of the nettlesome pieces of policy. So that's a real problem for the tandem. I think just in terms of your description of the White House staff, there is incompetence in the service of the goals that Donald Trump wants to achieve. And that's, you know, to the extent that the executive order was badly framed and argued and has gotten clotted up because it was rushed, that's a way in which the incompetence undermines a central goal of the Trump presidency. That is separate and apart from the criticism they get for being chaotic and wanting to blow up the system, which is not a bug, but a feature. And so we need to disentangle all the stuff you read in the paper about chaos, because a lot of that chaos is chaos for which they are cheering. And so that's just a sort of way to split what you described as the raggedness of the White House.
Julia, we'll give you the last word on this. So one question I have is, can Trump still continue to have this strangely sycophantic suck-up and detente relationship with Putin's Russia, given all these revelations? Or does he have to, is he going to be forced to basically be hard on Russia because otherwise it looks like he's being blackmailed and is a patsy for them?
Well, so far we have a pretty bad track record of forcing Donald Trump to be any one way or the other. He doesn't, like Putin, doesn't really respond to pressure in that way. If anything, he digs his heels in more. But you're already seeing, and people I've talked to in Moscow are noticing this, what Spicer said on Crimea, that Putin, literally happens all the time now, that Trump didn't walk back. That Trump didn't walk back and instead the next day tweeted that Russia took Crimea, and he had it in all caps while Obama was president, and I'm accused of being weak on Russia, when it, you know, obviously implying that Obama was weak on Russia. And people in Moscow noticed that, and now there's a lot of contortions going on in Moscow, being like, well, actually, in English, that verb is not what you quite think it is. It's softer. It's like it.
Which verb? Took?
Take. Oh. To take. You know, or they're overlooking the fact that, you know, here everybody was outraged by agreeing with Bill O'Reilly when he called Putin a killer. But in Russia, people noticed, well, he didn't disagree with him. He just said, we're also killers. That said, in Russia, there's a difference between all the chatter going on and what Putin thinks. He is the one decision maker in Russia. So I can't imagine that Putin did not know that this guy that, A, I don't think he expected him to win. But when he won, I'm not sure that he thought he was going to get a completely pliant, predictable person. I think he knows what's up. And I think he figured that, okay, now we have this guy. We're going to deal with him. We're going to push him for all we can. There will be a break, inevitably. It's a question of when, not if. But it's going to come from the American side. It's going to come from Trump realizing that he's being seen as weak and as being a patsy for Putin.
The other point I thought you made really well in a piece you wrote this week was that Putin wins either way, that he placed this long shot bet on this guy who has all the qualities you said, and that if Trump opposes him, then that's a very familiar dynamic. And then Putin's in the nice, comfortable place of, as usual, running against the United States.
Right. And so much of these decisions are driven by domestic factors. And Putin's one goal is to stay in power. He has to stay in power. He has become a hostage to this situation he himself has created, where there's nobody to take the throne after him. And it helps him to have a chaotic, toxic hellscape, whatever you called it, in the White House, because ever since 1991, Russians and citizens of the Eastern European states that were once Warsaw Pact members have been longing for, striving for the Western European way of life, both in terms of consumerism and politics. And his goal has always been to say, look, it's not a one-size-fits-all model, and they're no better. They're not more moral, they're not more efficient, not more effective, so why not play for your own damn team? So the more chaotic the White House and the more chaotic the U.S., the more Russia seems attractive.
And so, in a sense, he's already won. All he needs is chaos, so he's got it.
And it's an old, old Soviet tactic, going back to the 20s and 30s, that the Bolsheviks used to shore up their support at home, which was to constantly portray the capitalistic West, and it was easy to do in the 30s during the Depression, when actually a lot of black sharecroppers from the South moved to the Soviet Union and were lured over to the Soviet Union to help them develop their cotton industry. You see it in the art, in the literature, in the, you know, newsreels and the newspapers from the time, that the West is garbage. There's no worker protections. Everybody's living in tenements and women are being forced into prostitution to feed their families. Theodore Dreiser was incredibly popular in the Soviet Union and pushed on people in the Soviet Union. This is a super old tactic from the Soviet playbook.
And there are historians who think that the civil rights movement was partly a response to what the Russians and communists were saying about Americans' failures with African Americans and other minority groups.
Julia, thank you. That was awesome. Julia Yaffe, staff writer at The Atlantic, come by and visit anytime there's some horror show happening. That's when we love to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
It's almost March. Obamacare has been repealed and replaced. Or has it been? It has not been. There is a strange lack of action on the signature obsession of congressional Republicans. News this week came that the IRS is essentially going to allow people to duck out of getting coverage without paying a penalty. So there's no longer going to be any real enforcement of the Obamacare mandate. You can now cheat on your taxes and not pay a penalty.
Although, to be fair, they weren't really enforcing it much beforehand either. But
they sort of announced it. They're like, go ahead, cheat
right.
us.
Right. That is a problem when you say, go ahead
but
and
the
cheat,
lack
right?
of enforcement before is one of the reasons that it was that it was having
shaking.
Issues.
Meanwhile, a major insurer, Humana.
Right? I think it's Humana.
Humana. They are dropping out of the exchanges in 2018. Yet what is not happening is not a lot of action in Congress, at least on the surface. Congressional efforts to act seem frozen. There was also news this week that the House Freedom Caucus, the very right part of the extremely generally right House Republican majority, is demanding a quick and immediate repeal and don't want to attach any replacement to it, just want to repeal it. Coterie of 50 Republicans who want it. To think that that has to happen now, and we can't lard it up with all these replacement things, which might not be able to pass or might get delayed. John, is this a thing which is, it's actually like a duck, where under the surface there is in fact a huge amount of action and really there is progress, or is it, are they paralyzed?
Well, I think there's been a lot of action. The question is whether there's been a lot of progress. Dun, dun, dun,
dun. The duck is paddling. Is it getting anywhere?
That's why John hosts Face the Nation.
This to me is a moment to pause and say this is something that really matters. It affects not only the people who are on the Affordable Care Act, it affects all the people whose insurance will be affected by the collateral damage or has been affected by the collateral damage of the Affordable Care Act or will be affected by the whatever changes are made to it. Big, serious, important issue. What's going on right now is essentially chaos, depending on how you want to look at it. First of all, we should remember the 60-plus votes about repealing it, and the fact that there is not and was not a piece of legislation to replace it uncovers what was essentially a totally political maneuver from the beginning and an unserious effort to repeal. Now, that's fine if you want to do that for political reasons, just fine. But when you are making hay from somebody else having made the tough decisions, and maybe they made the tough decisions and made them horribly, but at least they tried to engage with the tough decisions of American healthcare, which is not easy. When you are saying, you know what, it is easy to fix this, and we'll fix it the minute we get in, and then the president has said, we will offer you something that covers everyone, and he said coverage, not access. He said it'll allow you to pick your doctor. He said the coverage will be better. He said more people will be covered. And it'll all happen fast and simultaneously. He said in the middle of January, a month ago, that he had an alternative that was almost done. He doesn't. And why doesn't he? Because of the totally natural and reasonable conflicts between people trying with differing views to create something that's big and complicated. That is all fine and totally natural and normal. What is not is that so much time was spent suggesting that it could be done quickly and easily, and that any alternative was a total mess, not because of the messiness of the process, but because of the bad motives and stupidity of the people engaged in it. And so that's where we are.
Emily, do you think that Republicans are as dismissive of the grassroots anger that's appearing at town halls and meetings as they've appeared to be in public, where people like Jason Chaffetz have said, oh, this is just, you know, people are paid, or they're outsiders, or they're not really, you know, they don't represent my constituents? Or do they know that this is a real genuine anger, and they're just saying that because they have to say it? Are they
just saying that because they have to say it, and it's genuine enough, certainly, that they're making them uncomfortable. You know, those statements like Chaffetz's are undermined by various conservatives saying don't make the mistakes that the Democrats made with the Tea Party in 2009 and dismiss this as astroturf and paid protesters when you have no evidence of that, because these folks are riled up and they're going to show up at the polls and they're organizing. And I think we have to give these town halls and this organizing a lot of credit for what's happening right now, because it has crystallized exactly these questions that, you know, are crucial to what should happen with the healthcare system. I mean, I was really interested that one of the things, so Jim Sensenbrenner, like stalwart Republican from Wisconsin, I can't imagine he's had a close election in like 20 years.
He won by 37 points last
146,000 votes, I read.
Yeah. Thank you. He has someone shouting at him at a town hall, how many times did you vote to repeal this thing without having a replacement? 60? Like, doesn't? And that hits home in a way that is different from criticism from, you know, someone you can dismiss. That's your constituent. I think, of course, they're paying attention to it and it matters.
I had an idea, by the way. John, you can tell me this is a crazy idea. Would liberals be smart to make tiny donations to Republican members of Congress and call up as donors? I feel like one of the things that happens is that donors get attention and non-donors you just sort of write off.
No,
I don't. And that would give you authority.
I don't think so. I think, I mean, it depends. You'd have to keep up the, ruse. Yeah. Because the way the donors get in is through, there's a kind of gatekeeping system, which is to say, like, Joe says, oh, here's Billy, he gave to you. If you're just a small dollar donor, they really, really want you because they think you can give more, but they don't want to hear from you necessarily. They just want your email address and they want to keep
But don't they happy. Want don't they want to keep me happy?
Yeah, but I don't think to the extent, not to the extent that they're going to, like, sit and listen to you.
No.
Because you'd have to think of all the people you'd have to listen to. It's a lot of people. So I don't think that would really, it might get you a different phone number, you know, like the donor phone number, but I still don't think that would get you a, yeah.
Well, Gaffes listeners, try that out with your member of Congress.
That's David's scam idea for the day. That's another
scam.
One next week.
It's not a scam.
Not a scam. Clever ruse.
John, what are the actual major hangups that Republicans are facing with the replacement piece? Is it the Medicaid subsidies? Is it the...
It's a great question.
The whole thing!
Yeah, well, it's speed. It's whether you dismantle it immediately and replace it or whether you have to phase it out. There's the Medicaid piece. There is the Medicare piece. Paul Ryan's plan includes reforming Medicare in a way that could be characterized as, at the very least, changing the system.
Awful.
At
the very least could be, but the threshold politically is that, just if we can bore in on the Medicare piece of it for a moment, is the threshold politically is if he touches it at all, he will have run afoul of what President Trump has said and wanted and reiterated. Now, there is some potential wiggle room in the Trump White House. A Republican senator I was talking to this week was saying that they now hear the White House saying, well, we don't want you to mess with Medicare for current retirees. Now, that's a switch from what Donald Trump said repeatedly in the campaign and what his aides have said since he won the election. So it's a, but it
There's
is
some 55-year-olds out there not going to be happy to hear that switch.
But it is a switch that recognizes that in order to do what Paul Ryan wants to do to replace the Affordable Care Act, it requires a Medicare piece. The challenge then, though, comes whether Donald Trump, when he goes to have his rally Friday in Florida, he's not going to be, going on and on about how great it is, all the new things you're going to get in this Medicare change. Is it going to be the kind of thing that he's going to end up not wanting to really like talk about or get bogged down with because it's complicated, it's kind of itchy, and it relies on people believing in a theory of the healthcare market that's yet to be proved. Now that, as we've talked about before, happens all the time with legislation. You make a bet that things are going to work out the way you want, and people have to just hope the people in power have the right theory about the way the market works.
There is no universe in which market-based healthcare systems work. Well, people do not have information. They're operating under duress. It doesn't work.
Well, whether
it's
that,
not just that, we have no evidence. We have a lot of counter evidence.
That may
right?
be whatever. The point is that as a sales technique, it's not that fun for Donald Trump to go out and talk about that piece of it. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch. But I think also we have a bigger question at the heart of this, which is that Republican leadership would like members to think strategically and long term about how to get this done, that it requires several steps in and be patient and let us go from A to B to C to D. The problem is that A, there are some group of people who want to move from A to D immediately and who frame anyone who wants to take those intermediate steps as capitulating, not true to the cause, ideologically weak. The problem is the president who is in that camp. I mean, he's the one who said we can go from A to D. It will be painless. You'll be able to keep your doctor. Your kids will be able to stay on your plan. Pre-existing conditions will be covered. There won't be any lifetime caps. All of the things that are the good
parts. The pony, you left out the pony.
Right. And so those expectations keep being raised. And so I guess the big point I'm making about strategy is rational Republican leaders are calling for a systematic piece-by-piece approach, and the energy of the party and the energy of the president is in just exactly the opposite direction, which is we can do it fast and make it better and let's go.
Emily, if you had to bet, would you think there is going to be a repeal and replace in this year?
I like so don't care what I think. Like my predictions about this are of no interest to me. But I am interested in what's happening in the meantime, which is this statement, wasn't it the head of Aetna this week who said that Obamacare is in a death spiral? So the Republicans are kind of breaking this very complex machine for healthcare that was built by creating all this uncertainty that's making insurers pull out.
Do they own it yet? Who owns it now?
Let Emily keep going. Keep going, and then we'll...
Well, I mean, I think that's the question, is whether they own it yet. It seems to me like it's not rocket science that this uncertainty is not helping the insurance companies. But they made some rule changes this week, which were an effort to change it. Underlying all of this, though, is I think part of the explanation for why they're stuck, which is... part of their opposition is just purely ideological, right? So my colleague Robert Draper has a piece this week where he talked to the Heritage Foundation guy, who's like the guru of the conservative thinking on this, according to Robert. And that guy, whose name is not in my brain, said, you know, this is about having the government involved in 1/6 of the economy. Of course, we have to get the government out of this. And that's not about who gets healthcare coverage, the quality of that coverage, whether people with pre-existing conditions are covered. It's not about whether Americans live or die or are sick or healthy or get to see their doctors. It's just a purely ideological idea about healthcare. And when you look at other Western countries that have good healthcare systems, their governments are involved in this sector of the market more heavily than ours is.
Right. And so, also governments are involved in things like, I mean, the military is one, it's not 6 of the economy, but it's 5% of the economy. That's an entirely government activity. We're not like get government out of military spending. That's a core function of government.
Well, I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to argue that that you can have government out as much as possible of healthcare. But if you're going to make that argument, it requires a sustained, focused conversation in which everybody's coordinated and together and making the same case. So you cannot have chaos to make that argument. Because why? Because people are terrified when it comes to healthcare, either because they have somebody who's sick in their family, or they know somebody who's sick, or they're one paycheck away from being devastated by medical costs. And also they're frustrated by healthcare because most of us, when we interact with healthcare, even when we have the best that is available, it is a frustrating, soul-deadening, miserable experience. And so there's a lot of emotion, raw emotion in this issue, waiting to find an outlet for abuse, to punish. And so anybody who makes the ideological case here has to be super careful about the way they go through it. The on the question of who owns this, I was interested in that New York Times account that we apparently all read about Congressman Sensenbrenner. There was a quote in it from the congressman who said, from a political standpoint, we Republicans know that we will own whatever the replacement will be, just as Obama and the Democrats owned the Affordable Care Act. So that's interesting because Sensenbrenner is saying what's obvious. But he's arguing against what Donald Trump has tried to say. And Trump has said, basically, we're saving Democrats. Obamacare was a disaster and we're saving them by repealing it. In fact, both are right, which is it is in a death spiral. Now, you can have a debate about whether it's in a death spiral because Congress wouldn't do the fixes that are necessary to keep it from going into a death spiral or because it was fundamentally built in the beginning in a way that was unfixable. But it is in a death spiral. One of the debates is, do you repair it? Do you do basically the stuff that President Obama wanted, plus a few market-based things, and fix it? Or do you completely change it? And even if you're going to completely change it, you may have to keep it alive for long enough so that you can meet one of the promises that Donald Trump and others have made, which is that all the people who are covered now will be able to keep their coverage. That's one of the big tensions here.
The other thing is you have to spend money to fix it.
Yes, you do. And you have to administer it to fix it. I mean, so you're administering a plan that people hate.
Now, wait a second. Obama's care is more popular now than it has been. Your base might hate it, but actually the country is
I'm sorry. I was speaking in the minds of the Republicans.
Okay, let's wrap it there for now. I'm sure we will be talking about this a lot in weeks to come.
The future of America is in your hands. This is not a movie trailer, and it's not a political ad, but it is a call to action. I'm Mila Atmos, and I'm passionate about unlocking the power of everyday citizens. On our podcast, Future Hindsight, we take big ideas about civic life and democracy and turn them into action items for you and me. Every Thursday, we talk to bold activists and civic innovators to help you understand your power and your power to change the status quo. Find us at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
John has been summoned away to a presidential press conference. So we're going to continue the show without him. Sadly, he was an emergency departure. So it's just
one
me and
more
Emily.
Thing to blame President Trump for, John's departure.
But so it goes. Bibi Netanyahu made this flamboyantly crazy week even crazier. He came to Washington for a quick visit with President Trump. And of course, Trump made news at his semi-press conference. I call it a semi-press conference because he only took questions from incredibly favorable conservative press, and he's not taking questions from anybody he doubts their loyalty of, I think.
Can we note that he talked about his Electoral College victory when asked about the rise in anti-Semitic hate incidents?
I'm interested to know how long he's going to, in 2019, when you ask him a question, is he going to talk about historic Electoral College victory? Is he still going to be referring to that? But Trump said essentially that the one-state solution, two-state solution in Israel and Palestinian territory, who cares? Doesn't matter. He basically abandoned the 25-year rhetorical commitment the United States has made to the two-state solution. Admittedly, I would say in his defense, the two-state solution, what's been going on? Not been going on. There's not been a lot of progress there, largely because Palestinians have not been great negotiating partners, and Israel's been led by an awful leader who has no interest in negotiation in Bibi Netanyahu. But Emily, is this a big deal that Trump's like one state, two states, three states, four, five states, six states, eight states more?
So my first reaction just was like, I literally felt like my heart was breaking. And then I was trying to understand why, because everything you said is true. And what I realized is that there sort of were two tracks I was taking this in. So one was feeling like the president had made this irresponsible break with past policy with no alternative. And the more I read people who are smarter than me about this talking about, you know, what Trump's and I guess Jared Kushner and David Friedman, this very right-wing potential Israeli ambassador, their plan is some idea of getting the Gulf states that have been getting a little closer to Israel on combating Iran to somehow get them to broker a peace deal with the Palestinians, even though they don't want that deal because they do not want to look like they're siding with Israel against the Palestinians. That's very bad in their home turf. And Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, doesn't want this deal for the reasons that you were just talking about. So there's the way in which this feels just totally irresponsible and clumsy and bumbling and kind of pathetic. But then I realized the reason I was upset about this is that I feel deeply attached to the state of Israel, having lived there a long time ago, but grown up with some sense of like excitement and attachment to Israel as like a moral place. And if this two-state solution is no longer on the table, and we're talking about a one-state solution in which it's either not democratic, which seems what Netanyahu has in mind, or it's not Jewish. Neither of those have anything to do with my values about the state of Israel. So I was talking to my kids about this last night, and my younger son realized that a lot of Palestinians in the West Bank don't vote. And he said, he couldn't believe that. And there's a way in which, and maybe this is selfish on the part of American Jews, but American Jews have ideas about Israel that they now have no story to tell that I can see, that is a way of feeling good about this country. And that's it for me personally, a huge break. And so I just feel so sad about that idea, and the idea that the American government right now would be so completely unhelpful and in league with a leader of Israel who I see as just like poisonous.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, the most moral thing that if the Israelis refuse to do a two-state solution, and they will not have they also refuse to have democracy, then they should expel all the Palestinians. Like, they can't, I mean, to occupy as a colonial power in that way is just a totally immoral thing to do indefinitely. It's wrong. They shouldn't do it. I mean, of course.
And yet, expulsion and ethnic cleansing is also a terrible crime.
Yeah, no, it is. No, they're all terrible.
They're all terrible. Right. They've left themselves with no good options because they refuse to recognize their own demographic reality. And I should say, we're obviously not talking about all Israeli people, but we are talking about their elected government right now.
Well, and also, one of the things that happened is that within Israel, I mean, I haven't been there for a couple of years, so I'm sure I'm about to say something grotesque and generalizing that isn't true. But there's a way in which the rich coastal part of the country around Tel Aviv is very much insulated from any of this. That there's not Israelis don't go to the West Bank anymore. Sort of, you can live in a kind of Tel Aviv coastal zone and not have to face every day the moral crime that your nation is committing in your name. And then there's this plurality growing to a majority of people who support the settlements, who are very religious, who don't even care. And so you have a group of people who are shielding themselves and a group of people who don't care. And the result is this weird bifurcated society.
Well, I'm just going to add, there are a lot of Israelis for whom this is horrifying and who oppose it, my friends among them, but they don't have sufficient power right now to do
that. Right, and never will. And the only power they have, honestly, is like it's what white South Africans who were appalled by apartheid did, which is there's the power of political action, but you may not win, and it's the power of leaving. It's why there was a massive exodus of white South Africans, especially white South African Jews during the apartheid era, because they just couldn't be complicit. And I think there are a lot of Israelis who don't want to be complicit. And that diminishes the political power of the very left that opposes what Netanyahu supports.
Right. And yet, in this moment where other Western democracies like ours are not seeming terribly attractive or completely stable, the idea that, you know, we're at risk of losing a democratic and Jewish version of this homeland, the Zionist vision of more than 100 years, this is not the right time.
Do you think it's good that Trump will spend energy? He's going to dispatch his son-in-law Jared Kushner, whose qualification seems to be that he is Jewish. He's going to dispatch Kushner to
don't forget Bibi Netanyahu slept in his bedroom when he was a kid.
Do you think it's good for the Trump administration to deal with Israel and the Palestinian situation? I just don't know what the upside is. I don't know where the gain is. I don't know. They're not going to negotiate peace. There's not going to be a settlement. And so should they even bother?
Well, it seems like I also can't see an upside. It seems like there's a downside. I mean, they're destabilizing things. They're making the Palestinians feel even more disempowered. There could be outbreaks of violence in response to this perceived shift in American policy, even if it amounts to nothing. It seems kind of dangerous to have them meddling around in such a volatile part of the world.
Also, the guy that Trump has nominated as ambassador, holy cow.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
He's a just you know, massive funder of settlements and is so right wing. It's just demoralizing. The whole thing is demoralizing. It's also, there's this delusion that Trump seems to have that, oh, these Arab states, the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are going to, they're going to pressure the Palestinians to accept a deal because everyone needs to be allied against Iran. And so the Saudis now, you know, the Saudis and the Israelis are close allies against Iran. And therefore, those Arab states are going to, you know, make the Palestinians accept something. I mean, that's just insane. Doesn't make any sense.
Right. I mean, amazing to have five former ambassadors stretching back to Reagan sign a joint letter opposing David Friedman, the about to be, I suppose, or whatever, certainly nominated to be Israeli ambassador. I mean, there is a bipartisan diplomatic consensus that that the Trump administration is up to no good here.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. We don't have John to chatter historically about anything. It's just going to be me and you chattering, Emily. I wish one of us could come up with something super historical.
Oh, not me. I only have downer chatters.
President Harding, what do you got?
So I'm sure some of our listeners have seen this story, but it's another story that broke my heart this week. ICE, our immigration and customs enforcement folks, detained a victim of domestic violence who'd gone to court in El Paso to get a protective order against the person who she said was abusing her. Apparently, the tip might have come from her alleged abuser. And so now we have this kind of just Kafka-esque dire situation in which people who are crime victims are being targeted when they seek help. I just can't really think of anything more diabolical for our immigration authorities to be doing.
It's absolutely diabolical. There's no other word that is right. That story,
chilling,
was disgusting. My chatter, I have two chatters. One quick one, which is just, I don't know if people saw news, but those of you who are Philip Pullman fans, rejoice. There was a story this week that Pullman has a new trilogy that he's preparing to release, which is in the same universe as his Dark Materials trilogy. It's going to be called The Book of Dust. I don't know if the whole thing is The Book of Dust or the first book of The Book of Dust.
I love Dust.
It's not a sequel or a prequel. It seems to take place almost kind of contemporaneously with the other books, and it's going to be about dark matter, dust. He's been thinking a lot about the cosmological significance of dust, and he wanted to investigate it more. And so it's going to be this books, and if they are even one-tenth as good as his Dark Materials, they will be better than anything else I've read this year. So
I can't wait.
Yeah. My other chatter is just, did you see this incredible letter that a psychiatrist named Alan Francis wrote to the New York Times? The New York Times had written a story about people who were diagnosing Donald Trump as a narcissist. And Alan Francis, as the letter I'm about to read will tell you, disagrees with the pop diagnosis. And I just want to read this letter. It's so great. To the editors, fevered media speculation about Donald Trump's psychological motivations and psychiatric diagnosis has recently encouraged mental health professionals to disregard the usual ethical constraints against diagnosing public figures at a distance. They've sponsored several petitions and a February 14th letter to the New York Times suggesting that Trump is incapable on psychiatric grounds of serving as president. Most amateur diagnosticians have mislabeled President Trump with a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. I wrote the criteria that define this disorder, and Mr. Trump doesn't meet them. He may be a world-class narcissist, but this doesn't make him mentally ill because he does not suffer from the distress and impairment required to diagnose mental disorder. Mr. Trump causes severe distress rather than experiencing it, and has been richly rewarded rather than punished for his grandiosity, self-absorption, and lack of empathy. is a stigmatizing insult to the mentally ill, who are mostly well-behaved and well-meaning, to be lumped with Mr. Trump, who is neither. Bad behavior is rarely a sign of mental illness, and the mentally ill behave badly only rarely. Psychiatric name-calling is a misguided way of countering Mr. Trump's attack on democracy. He can and should be appropriately denounced for his ignorance, incompetence, impulsivity, and pursuit of dictatorial powers. His psychological motivations are too obvious to be interesting, and analyzing them will not halt his headlong power grab. The antidote to a dystopic Trumpian dark age is political, not psychological.
That is fabulous.
Such a great letter.
I'm so glad you found that.
Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at panoply.fm. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @slategabfest. Our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. If you like the show, subscribing, commenting, and rating really help us. Search for Slate Political GabFest in the iTunes store. For Emily Bazelon and the vanished John Dickerson and Julia Yaffe, I'm David Plotz. I hope we'll see you at our live show in LA on March 1st or in DC on May 10th. Go to slate.com/live for tickets, and we'll certainly talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.